Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, December 5th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, energy expert describes uncertainty with Humboldt Offshore Wind Energy. 2 decades reporting on the Klamath. And Ray Hamill with the sports report. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Offshore wind energy projects are slated off Humboldt County coast, but they're on hold due to a change in federal leadership. Daniel Mintz reports.
A leading local energy researcher has described Humboldt's offshore wind energy projects as being in a waiting game while political and economic changes play out. The history and future of Humboldt County energy development was the topic of a December 3rd presentation from Arnie Jacobson of the Schatz Energy Research Center at Cal Poly Humboldt. In an online meeting of the Community Economic Resilience Consortium, Jacobson's presentation showed how the evolution of Humboldt's energy development accelerated in the 2 decades following World War II, but has remained static since. The first major expansion of the county's energy infrastructure since the mid-1960s is on the drawing board, however, as wind energy projects are slated for 2 areas offshore of Eureka. The timeline for completion of the transmission upgrade needed to accommodate the new form of energy is late 2034, but, quote, all of that could shift and could end up being a bit later, Jacobson said. That's because momentum on offshore wind energy was frozen when President Donald Trump regained office, and Jacobson described offshore wind energy development as an interactive process.
For something like offshore wind to proceed, you need infrastructure, so you need the port to be developed, you need the transmission facilities, and you need offshore wind developers who are interested to proceed with that. You also need, you know, the offshore wind happens in federal waters, and so you need federal support in order for that to proceed. You can't do it if the federal government is not willing to at least to allow that process to proceed. And you need the state to be a supporter. So in some ways, you can think of the federal government, the state, and the private sector in that context as 3 legs of a stool. And if one of those legs goes out, it's hard to make that proceed. I think right now, California remains interested at the state level, but they also recognize that they need a federal administration that they can work with in order to advance it. And so they're waiting to see what happens in the next election.
The consequences of federal non-cooperation include the reeling back of a $427 million grant to the Humboldt Bay Harbor District for port development. The transmission upgrade would be paid for by ratepayers statewide, but it's a major project that hinges on federal support.
My understanding of the circumstance now is that they want it to, the planning of that to continue. They want the developer to not spend any big money, because any money that gets spent, the ratepayers of the state are eventually on the hook for. They don't want to cancel it because they don't want, you know, because if they cancel it, then that sort of seals off the possibility of offshore wind developing eventually. And so they're sort of in a waiting game to see what's going to happen, and are trying to set things up so that just a small amount of planning money gets spent on it so that it could be ready to move forward if things will look more favorable in a few years. And I think the industry is in that same waiting game. They're not able to advance, but they also don't want to pull back from the leases that they have. And so they're waiting to see if a few years from now there'll be a more favorable environment.
The recent turnabout, compounded by economic circumstances, has affected the offshore wind energy industry. Last fall, the 2 global companies that paid a combined $331 million for Humboldt's offshore wind energy development leases announced layoffs, with one of them laying off about 100 workers. The uncertain future was discussed in this exchange between Jacobson and the meeting's host, Greg Foster of the Redwood Region Economic Development Commission.
So all of that stuff is is intertied and everyone's looking at each other to say, what are you going to do before they want to make a move? So I think we're kind of in a holding game around a lot of that. And the question is, can the things that have been approved or that are lined up stay lined up without having too much expenditure on them and waiting for a more favorable situation? But at a certain point, people end up saying, I can't put more money into this, or I can't put more effort into this. And so it's certainly not guaranteed that people can wait forever on where they've made some preliminary investments. So I think that that's the circumstance we're in at the moment.
So it sounds like our next big signal will be the first Tuesday after the first Monday in 20, November 2026, and we'll see how the midterms go, and we'll know what federal policy may or may not be at that point. Who knows? Nothing like uncertainty to chill investment.
For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
The Klamath River is going through a historic turnaround. Since the four hydroelectric dams were removed a little over a year ago, scientists and surveyors have seen a drastic jump in salmon population from Humboldt all the way up to southern Oregon. This was not always the case. This dam removal took decades of different groups working together to make this happen. For more than 2 decades, journalist Dan Backer has covered the Klamath River, reporting on the salmon, the dam removal movement, and the tribes fighting for the river. He first became involved in the fight to remove the Klamath dams after reporting on the salmon fish kills in 2002. Since then, he has reported on protests, meetings, and marches related to the removal of the dams.
For many years, I've worked as an editor for a fishing magazine called The Fish Sniffer, formerly out of Northern California Inward Publications. And I became active in the movement to bring down the dams, particularly after I covered the 2002 Klamath fish kill, where over 38,000 salmon died. And that was a wake-up call to the Klamath River tribes, to environmentalists, to fishermen, to try to remedy the situation. And, beginning in the early 2000s, we had a march in 2004 that was attended by tribal leaders from the Klamath tribes, from the Yurok tribe, the Hoopa Valley tribe, and also from the Karuk tribe, and also supporters from the Winnetou tribe in the Redding area. And we had a march basically to push for the restoration of the Klamath, including dam removal. And, I've been involved just when it started. It really, the momentum started building in 2004 when we had that march. And, it's been habit has the dam removal process had its ups and downs over the years, but finally we got the state and federal governments to agree to the dam removal, and we got the PacifiCorp company that's owned by Warren Buffett to agree to bring down the dams. And now we're seeing the results.
The results are staggering so far.
So most recently, the CalTrout, which is one of the organizations that worked on dam removal, they did a survey from a sonar fish counting station that they set up below the former Iron Gate Dam after Iron Gate Dam brought down, and reveals that nearly 10,000 salmon have migrated up. These are adult-sized fish, and they were still counting at the last time they posted their results. And this result is 30% higher than the group's fish counts at the same time last year.
Backer explained this whole process is just the beginning. He hopes that this entire journey will start helping other dam removal movements.
CalTrout and other groups and the tribes are saying, this has hopefully become a model. Now, we're not out of the woods yet. These fish aren't built up to historical levels, but we're hoping that by being able to access the higher cold spring-fed tributaries that, the salmon will be able to get through climate change, because we know that climate's going to be a lot drier in California, at least according to the scientists. So this will ensure that we have salmon for the future. And hopefully there will be enough fish that return this season so that they could open up at least a limited fishery in the Klamath management zone in the ocean, but we won't know the statistics, the final counts. It's promising so far, but we don't have the final counts of how many fish returned on the Klamath River. By the way, the Klamath River is really been a spectacular fishery for many years, but it really declined in recent years. The last really good year was 2012 when I fished and I had my best day of salmon fishing ever on the river below the dam, the Iron Gate Dam, which is the lowest down on the river. But that dam is gone, and those fish can go up in the tributaries and spawn now. It's amazing.
This is just the first step, because there are many more dams up and down California that still need to be removed.
There's other dam removal processes like a coalition of tribes, environmental groups, fishing groups, are trying to get the Snake River dams removed, which is a bigger river than the Klamath. But this is something that took well over 20 years to come to fruition. And it took a lot of hard work, took a lot of negotiation, and a lot of disappointment, too, along the way. But finally, in 2023 and 2024, they actually physically brought the dams down and was brought down by a dam or a river restoration foundation called the KRRC, the Klamath River Renewal Corporation. And they're the ones that did the dam removal in coordination with the tribes, with the fishing groups and the environmental groups. And, you know, it's gratifying to see that the fish came back so quickly, because there was a lot of naysayers that said that the salmon, you know, wouldn't return for many years, and they returned as soon after they removed the dams. And there's more of them this year. So it's one of the biggest environmental battles we've had in California over the last 20 years. And it's real gratifying to see that the fish are actually going up in the tributaries. The Klamath tribes, who are based in Oregon, they've counted many salmon going up the tributaries to Upper Klamath Lake, where they hadn't been for over 100 years. These are the Sprague, the Williamson, the Wood Rivers, and other tributaries. And so, you know, salmon are now spawning throughout the watershed. It's like it's really a kind of amazing to see the fish spawning now in areas where they haven't been spawning for so many decades. This took place at a time when salmon populations are really threatened. And so we're not completely out of the woods yet, but the one that beside the fish going to the tributaries above the dams, they've also had three times the amount of salmon returning to the tributaries below the dams that have had salmon spawning from, you know, since the dams were built. And, you know, this occurs as you have other rivers like the Sacramento River and the San Joaquin River that have been suffered for many years because of water exports to agribusiness.
Looking back on the last 20 years, Backer remembered one moment that really stood out to him, the moment it was announced that the dams were finally going down.
Yeah, that was 3 years ago. You know, it was very much a joyous celebration that the dams were finally being removed because, you know, I got to emphasize, there was direct action protests involved in this. I accompanied the tribes and commercial fishermen on a trip to Omaha, Nebraska, to protest at Warren Buffett's annual stakeholders meeting. And, you know, they had tribal members that unfurled banners there. And then, like, members of tribes and other people, they got up there and spoke as shareholders. You see, we had shareholders' badges, so we were able to get into the convention hall in Omaha. And there's just, I mean, tons of protests, in Sacramento, in Eureka, and elsewhere. So, it was one of the most gratifying movements that I've covered as a journalist ever, because I cover fish politics, water politics, environmental justice in California. And I don't write just for Fishing Magazine. I write for Sacramento News and Review, Chico News and Review. I used to write for Truth Out. I wrote for the Stockton Record newspaper and a bunch of other publications too, including the Daily Cause website. So that's the story of the Klamath River.
Ray Hamill brings us details of all the big local sports stories of the week, including what's next for the Ferndale Wildcats after they secured a 15th all-time North Coast Section Championship in football over the weekend, all the latest high school and college basketball news, and why it was a big week for two local cross-country runners.
The Ferndale Wildcats are hoping for the opportunity to play for a state championship in football for the second time in 3 years after claiming a 15th all-time North Coast Section title last weekend. Hello and welcome to this week's KModa News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the Wildcats and their incredible success in just a moment as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including all the latest high school football news, why it was a big week for HDNL girls basketball, all the latest local college and high school basketball news, and why it was a memorable week for two local cross-country runners. But first up, an incredible season continued for the Ferndale Wildcats on the football field over the weekend as the most successful public school program in NCS football history added to its remarkable tally of section championships. The Wildcats travelled to Roner Park to play St. Vincent de Paul in the NCS Division 5 championship game and pulled away late on the way to a 26-14 win. The victory not only secured a 15th all-time section championship for the school, which is second only to De La Salle, but it also keeps the Wildcats season going and secured a place in this weekend's CIF state playoffs. The two schools were tied 7-7 at halftime, but the number 2 seeded Cats would begin to take control of the game with 3 unanswered touchdowns in the second half that opened up a 26-7 advantage. The Mustangs, who were seeded number 1, would respond with a late touchdown to narrow the deficit to 12, but that was as close as they would come, with the Ferndale defense in dominating form once again. The following day, the brackets and matchups were announced for the state playoffs, and there was some good news and some bad news for the Wildcats. Ferndale, a Division 7-sized program and the smallest school in the NCS out of 104 to field an 11-player program, was moved up to the 4AA bracket for the state playoffs because of their success this year. But the good news is they get to play their NorCal Regional Bowl game in Humboldt County. The Cats have been paired with Sutter High School, and the game will take place on Friday night at the Redwood Bowl, with kickoff set for 7:30 p.m. The winner of that game will advance to next week's 4AA state championship game against the SoCal champs, with that game set to be played in Southern California. Ferndale is the 8th HDNL team to qualify for the state playoffs in the past 11 years, with 5 of the previous 7 teams going on to win a state title. That impressive group includes St. Bernard's in 2015 and 2019, Fortuna in 2017, Ferndale 2 years ago, and Arcata last season. The Fortuna Huskies also played in an NCS championship game last weekend, but fell 59-21 to Bishop O'Dowd in the Division 6 decider. In the Division 3 bracket, the Ukiah Wildcats also lost a section championship game, falling 32-21 to El Cerrito. In local college basketball, meanwhile, it was a good week for several former HDNL players. On Saturday afternoon, the College of the Redwoods women's team welcomed College of Marin to the North Coast for a non-conference showdown, and remarkably 14 former league players featured on the two teams combined, including 3 playing for the Mariners. The Marin women won the game 74-67, with former McKinleyville Panther Bella Turner playing a key role and finishing with 10 points, 5 rebounds, and a remarkable 8 steals. Turner, who graduated from Mack High last year, was joined on the Mariners by Del Norte's Brooklyn Carter and Ferndale's Emily Sowers, who both also featured in the game. Former Arcata Tiger Nora Talty led the way for the home team, and the sophomore guard finished with a game-high 20 points and a game-high 13 rebounds. With the loss, which was their 4th straight, the CR women dropped to 4-5 on the season, while Marin improved to 5-3. In men's college action, CR split a pair of games on the road last weekend, falling 102-83 to Columbia College on Saturday before bouncing back to beat West Hills Coalinga on Sunday by a score of 78-55. The Corsairs, who are 6-4 on the season, will host their annual Coach Tregs Classic this weekend with games against Southwestern Oregon on Friday night and Mendocino on Saturday afternoon. The Cal Poly Humboldt teams will also be in action this weekend with home conference games against UC Merced on Saturday afternoon. The women take the court at 1, followed by the men at 3. In local high school basketball, meanwhile, it will be a busy weekend here on the North Coast with several HDNL varsity teams in action. The McKinleyville boys and Arcata girls are hosting their annual tournaments with championship games set for Saturday afternoon. The Fortuna Huskies are also included in the field for the boys tournament, while South Fork and McKinleyville are playing at the Arcata girls tournament. The Arcata girls tournament championship game will take place at 2:30, while the McKinleyville boys tournament final is set for 3:30. In other high school girls games this weekend, Del Norte is playing at the Wairika tournament, Eureka is playing at the Gridley tournament, Fortuna is in action at the Calusa tournament, Ferndale is at the Sandy Mac tournament, and St. Bernard's is playing at the Sonoma Valley tournament. Several local boys teams are also featuring in tournament action this weekend. Del Norte and Eureka are playing at the Wairika tournament, Arcata is playing at the Harlan Carter tournament, St. Bernard's is at the Montgomery tournament, Hoopa is at the Durham tournament, and South Fork is playing at the Redwood Classic tournament in Anderson Valley. And rounding out a busy week in local sports, a pair of HDNL cross-country runners made the trip to last weekend's CIF State Championships in Fresno. Eureka junior Ryder Bullman and Fortuna sophomore Juan Ornelas were both in action at the prestigious meet and each featured in the Division 4 Boys Championship race. Bullman led the way and finished 56th out of 209 runners in the division, with Ornelas just 9 spots further back in 65th. And that's this week's Caymud News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
In state news, last-minute tips as Medicare open enrollment ends Sunday. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
This Sunday, December 7th, is the last day to make changes to your Medicare plan as open enrollment comes to an end. Experts say the most important thing to do is make sure your doctors accept the plan you've chosen for 2026 or find out which plans they will take. Stephanie Fahuri is Program Director for the Health Insurance Counseling and Advocacy Program at the Center for Healthcare Rights in Los Angeles.
Every year during open enrollment, we see people that make a choice about their coverage without confirming with their providers whether or not they're in network or whether they take that type of coverage. And then come January, they are faced with a predicament where they are in a plan and cannot see their doctors.
Every Medicare beneficiary should have received a letter from their insurance company explaining any changes to their 2026 offerings. Anthem Blue Cross, for example, will no longer offer its Medicare Part D drug plan in California next year, and they're not the only one. This year, Californians had a choice of 16 Medicare Part D plans. Next year, it will drop to 12. You can compare Medicare plans offered in your zip code online at Medicare.gov. Fahuri says a little research might turn up a plan that fits your needs at a lower price.
Each year, many of the plans go up in cost, but might not actually be providing any additional benefits. So we've helped a number of folks switch their drug plans to a less expensive option, and they're maintaining the same amount of coverage.
People on covered California plans have until January 31st to make changes. Open enrollment dates for employer-based coverage varies by company, and Medi-Cal enrollment is open year-round. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The final day of the Special Chiefs meeting of the Assembly of First Nations was on Thursday, and there was continued pushback to the notion of a new pipeline to Canada's west coast and the lifting of a tanker ban along that coast. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, three federal cabinet ministers took the stage to address the chiefs.
The cabinet ministers included Rebecca Ulte, Minister of Crown Indigenous Relations, Mandy Galmasti of Indigenous Services, and Finance Minister François-Philippe Champagne. They were there to push the Prime Minister's agenda of major nation-building projects, and they stressed that they needed First Nations as economic partners. The main issue that continued to dominate discussion is the likelihood of a lifting of the oil tanker ban on the West Coast to support a new pipeline. Eldon Yellowhorn is an Indigenous Studies expert at Simon Fraser University. He says Native leaders have good reason to fear a lifting of the tanker ban.
Driven by fears of an oil spill, you know, the tanker ban, and for good reason. I mean, Exxon Valdez disaster in 1989, it still has its mark on the land and the sea around Alaska. And there's very real fears here that something similar could happen. It could wipe out entire coastal communities and their livelihoods. So there's a real fear about that particular resolution.
The key minister helping to advance the major project's agenda was not present for the final day. He had run into trouble last week when he brushed off concerns from coastal First Nations after he failed to meet with them before the signing of the pipeline agreement with Alberta. He did eventually meet with those First Nations, but some have said they weren't satisfied with what they heard. Many chiefs say the proposals for developing resources are an attack on First Nations rights. Some, however, have expressed an openness to pipeline ownership. Finance Minister François-Philippe Champagne told the meeting that Indigenous partnership was key to speeding up major projects, boosting economic growth, and strengthening Canada's position at home and abroad. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A Navajo children's television show is returning with a holiday special. Reporter Jill Freitas has more.
The Navajo Highway special is titled Yate Kishmish, which is Merry Christmas in Navajo. It's the show's first full holiday-themed episode. The creator of the series, filmmaker and musician Pete Sands, says the show teaches Navajo culture.
Parts of it is my childhood, and part of it is how I wish my childhood was. So it's a balance of both, and I think shining positivity on Indigenous cultures is important to do.
The series blends puppetry, storytelling, and Navajo humor, all set along the winding highways of the Navajo Nation. San says that a memory he had of a teacher using puppets to help children listen gave him the idea to use them in his show.
Seeing a teacher friend of mine who's trying to tell her first grade students to clean up, but they wouldn't listen to her. So she reached into her desk and she pulled out a hand puppet and started talking to her class and the puppet. And they listened to her, to the puppet, actually. And this is like a light bulb went off in my head, like, wait, there's something to this. Maybe I could use this.
The holiday episode highlights traditional winter teachings, including family gatherings, gratitude, and the meaning of giving. Season 2 of the series begins production next year.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Michael McCaskill, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Ray Hamill, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.